Nothing more obscure teachings found in the suttas is the Buddha's fivefold classification of poets. It's so obscure I can't even remember what it is now. And it's kind of tucked away at the end of a chapter in the Anguttara Nikaya, as if they had kind of 9 suttas in that particular section and they needed a 10th sutta and they wanted to fill it out somewhere. And so they put in a little saying about the 5 kinds of poets. One of them, I can't remember now, one of them remembers things according to as is passed down by tradition, and so different ways of doing poetry. And then the last one, of course, always in the Buddha's list, the last one is always the best. And the last one is the Patibhana, the one who improvises, who speaks according to their inspiration. And that reminded me of that when reciting the sutta this evening, and it talks about, you know, the Buddha praised each of the monks because they, in the Mahagosinga Sutta, because they each spoke yatha saki sakang patibhanang, according to their own inspiration. This word patibhana is a bit difficult to translate, but something like inspiration sometimes you translate, or sometimes eloquence. Would work. It is an interesting thing that with the monastic life that we become, we choose to become, in a sense, very depersonalized. The monastic form is something that's worn like an object that's been handled by many people. Like a piece of wood or a piece of rock or a piece of metal has been handled by many people and it gets worn down and smoothed. The jagged edges get worn off it. The same thing happens with words, and when forms of words get used by many people over many years, they get like worn down and perfected. This is what happens in for example, in things like rituals, ritual sayings, where the words, the mantras of the ritual have been repeated so many times that they lose their individual characteristics. They lose that quality of being something which is just uttered at one particular time. And they become something which is quite timeless, and something which is not so much spoken as incanted. And so you incant the same words. It's been said before you by so many times, so many people over such a long period of time. For example, when we recite the Parimokkha, and we're doing the same thing every fortnight as been done by bhikkhus and bhikkhunis for so many thousands of years, or when we do the chanting in the evening meeting and we come and chant Ittipiso Bhagava, and these things, these words have been spoken, been uttered by so many thousands, millions of people right across the world for 2,500 years. And they get polished. They get smoothed out. And when, for example, we give these words in praise of the Buddha, it's not the same as if we were giving our own personal praise of the Buddha. So if we wanted personally to express what the Buddha means to us and how we find the idea of the Buddha inspiring, then we wouldn't choose those same words. In a sense, those words are dead. They've been used so many times, they've become a cliché. The words of the chant. And if we wanted to try to express that for ourselves, we would have to look for some other words, other ways of saying that. We would want to find something unique for the occasion that would express our own feelings, our own ideas at that time. And so that would be something which would be particular. It would be real and true at that time, but maybe less real and true or less pertinent at other times. And so these ritual sayings don't have that quality. They don't have that quality of being the right thing at the right time, of expressing some kind of unique or particular individual or personal expression. They have a timeless quality, a universal quality. It's a very different kind of thing. And that universal quality performs a very different kind of function. And one of the functions that for example, those universal words form is that they bind a community together by intoning those words at the same time together. We are affirming an attitude, a perspective, a set of beliefs, a faith, an aspiration. Even though the exact details of how that, what that means is different for each of us, but still there's enough similarity that we can come together and in unity and in harmony express these words as one. And so they bring us together. So this is one of the functions that a myth has, or a story has, is to bring the community together and give it a sense of identity. In saying these words, doing this chanting, in a sense we are communing with that myth or that idea of the Buddha. Doing the chanting only has meaning for us because of what the Buddha, the idea of the Buddha, means for us. So of course none of us have actually seen the Buddha himself. Not in this lifetime anyway, maybe in the past we have. But in this lifetime we haven't seen the Buddha. And so there's a sense of there's a sense of needing that kind of connection or emotion or heart connection with the Buddha and what his story means. So what, one of the things we can connect with is the life of the Buddha, the events, what he did, what he said. And in a sense, the whole of the Buddhist scriptures can be understood as an extended narration of the life of the Buddha. Every one of the suttas or every one of the Vinaya rules starts out by saying the Blessed One was living at such and such. And so each sutta is actually an event in the life of the Buddha. And if we were to take that literally and to organize it properly, we could actually organize virtually every sutra and every episode in the Vinaya. If we had enough information, biographical information, we could actually organize all of that into a chronological account of the Buddha's life and the teachings that he gave from day to day. So this is kind of not something which is obvious from the suttas themselves, the structure of them, how they're organized, but it's still clearly implied. This is why we take the teachings so seriously. This is why we find the chanting of the homage to the Buddha is inspiring, because by saying those words with an idea in our mind, it connects us with the person who made those teachings, who did those things, who acted in that way. We have this idea in our mind that we've built up through our experience and knowledge. And doing the chant enables us to come together and to connect with that. And this is part of what it means to be Buddhist. So when we come along to ordain as monks and nuns, in a way where this is another way of expressing this kind of depersonalization, we're divesting ourselves of those things we use to assert our individuality. And of course out there in the world, this is what we people do, isn't it? We put on clothes, we do our hair, or we, you know, what kind of music we want to listen to, or kind of car we drive, or whatever. All of these things are expressions of our individuality. And, you know, you see people will always be judging and comparing regarding all of these kinds of things. So when we come to the monastery, we make that conscious choice to just not do that anymore. We all shave our hair, have the same haircut. We'll wear the same clothes. We all do the same kinds of things at the same time. And so we are, in a sense, we are internalizing with our lives and our practice that kind of, that same kind of worn and smoothed down quality that we can see in the chants and the myths and the rituals. So in a sense we're actually living inside a ritual. We go through the Upasampada ceremony or the Pabbaja ceremony and we come out of the other side and we're different, we look different, and that difference is permanent. It stays with us as long as we remain in this state of being a monk or a nun. that creates a sense of creates many things. One of the things that creates a sense of unity, so that we feel a communion and a oneness with other monks and other nuns that we might meet. Which is very nice. You immediately feel a connection. And this is one of the very lovely things for me being a monk, is that whenever I get the chance to meet other monks and nuns, that very often that one can relate very easily and very naturally with them. Even though maybe you only don't meet them very much or don't know them very well, but you can still understand each other very well and express to each other very openly and very clearly. And so this I find is a very nice aspect of being a monk. Of course, the danger in that, or the problem is that you start to believe it, in a sense, that we can sort of convince ourselves that somehow, because we've adopted this external form, that we also have the internal qualities of what it means to be a monk or a nun. We take it for granted. And this can be something both internal and external. It's something which other people project on us. But it's also something that we generate and project from within ourselves. So sometimes when we ordain as monks and nuns, there's an emphasis, especially in the early years, on conformity. And on restraining, curbing, fitting our behavior into the expectations of how a monk or a nun is supposed to be. And that's not anything really unusual, you know, in any kind of job or position or place you have in society, no matter where you are or what you do, then there's always those kinds of expectations on how you should behave and so on. If you're working in a company, then you're supposed to have a neat haircut and wear a suit and have a tie and those kinds of things. If you're playing in a rock and roll band, you're expected to grow your hair long and do drugs. And if you don't, there's something wrong with you. And so these are this is normal. It's normal that this should happen. Hopefully, if that's done well, then that becomes something that's very organic and very integrative, that we're actually, through the, ideally, through the expectations and the controls that we place over our behavior of body and speech, these lead to the appropriate or beneficial states of mind which we're looking to develop as well. And so through, for example, restraining our speech and making sure that we always speak in a way that's very gentle and very positive, and not being aggressive and harmful and hurtful with our speech, for example, then that's helping us to and develop the right qualities of mind that we want to develop. Helps to make us happier. So I think that most of the time, certainly my experience of being a monk is that these things are very helpful, and they've always been very helpful for me. That just to reflect on this, who am I as a monk? I'm wearing this robe, the yellow robe, which has been worn by all the great arahants. And so you feel very proud to be able to do this. But at the same time very humble in the sense of, can I live up to that, or can I aspire to do that? And when we reflect on the amazing beings who have worn this robe, both in the past but also even in the present day, and we think of the amazing qualities that they've had, then we realize how little we deserve it, how little we're worthy of the robe. And as the Buddha said, you wear it as a someone in debt. Until you've realized enlightenment, you wear your robe as a debtor. So it certainly creates a sense of dignity and maturity in your outlook. And so all of those things are good, but the other side of that, the flip side of that, is that sometimes we can forget that thing that the Buddha was praising in the Mahagosinga Sutta, is the expression, yatasakang patibhana, according to one's own inspiration. And made quite a big impression on me one time when I met in Penang quite a senior Malaysian monk, and he was on the verge of disrobing. It was the first time I'd ever met him, and I kind of secretly knew that he was going to disrobe. He'd confided in somebody, in one of his close friends, that he was going to disrobe, and then the close friend, who was also my close friend, confided in me. And so actually I was hanging around the centre precisely to meet him and talk with him and see if there was anything that could be done, as the requirements of the Vinaya say. And but it was fairly obvious in talking to him that there wasn't anything that could be done. We didn't talk about his disrobal as such, but one of the things I found was very interesting that he expressed to me that he felt that he really had to suppress himself, or try to force himself to be in this kind of character in the robe. And you can kind of see this when just talking with him, that he was very he wasn't joyous, he wasn't natural. There was something that had gone wrong. Hard to pin it down, but there's just something had gone wrong. And he had ordained in the Burmese tradition, where as the monks are expected to conform to this kind of commentarial idea where the arahant can't laugh. So you're supposed to be very severe and strict and all of these kinds of things. And he just kind of felt that, this monk felt that he was being a kind of a fraud, pretending to be something that he wasn't. And I said, well, in the Thai tradition, they don't see things at all like that. And in the Thai forest tradition, then there's the monks are very relaxed and happy. They're always kind of laughing and joking around. And even monks who are supposed to be arahants, they still are very happy to have a good laugh, or even have a good old cry in public. And as well known, Ajahn Mahabhur has been seen in tears crying over the joy and the beauty of the Dhamma in public, and when this was criticized and people said monks shouldn't cry or arahants shouldn't cry, then he gave a huge Dhamma talk about that and ripped shreds off them, you know. And it's because when that kind of emotional heart contact with the Dhamma happens, it just brings something up. You can't explain it or describe it. And it creates this emotional response. And of course people have this idea about what Dhamma is, which they've got, I don't know where from, maybe from reading too much Abhidhamma or something. But they think that it's all, and they think there's something kind of, because they've never had any experience like that, they think it's kind of wrong to really feel the Dhamma, you know. But certainly in the Thai forest tradition, you know, there's a very, very healthy appreciation of eccentricity, and a lot of the monks have a very, you know, out there kind of characters, you know, and they, you know, some of them are renowned for being great jokers, like Ajahn Sing Tong, who was just like a practical joker. He used to joke around so much that Ajahn Tui refused to drive in a car with him, because whenever they would go through the villages, he'd be laughing uncontrollably at all of Ajahn Sing Tong's jokes, and he didn't want to break the Vinaya rule saying you shouldn't laugh loudly in a village. And so out of respect for that Vinaya rule, he never used to be able to drive in a car with Ajahn Sing Tong. And in the Ajahn Chah tradition, you have many, many typical examples. Ajahn Chah himself, of course, was renowned for his very quick-witted responses, especially when the Western monks were concerned. And some of the jokes that he asked the Western monks are too bawdy to repeat here, but one, for example, one of the less ripe ones, and this will give you an example of how ripe the real ripe ones are, but the less ripe ones was when one of the monks came along and said that he'd ordained in India underneath the Bodhi tree. But instead of saying he ordained underneath the Bodhi tree, he mistakenly, because his Thai wasn't very good, he said he ordained underneath a fart. And of course, when he said that in public, all of the Thai monk all cracking up laughing, and this kind of poor young Western monk who was just there and, you know, is in a new country for the first time, he's in this new monastery with his great, you know, imagine how intimidated he felt, and all the monks laughing. And Ajahn Chah was the only one who didn't laugh, and he just kept a dead straight face and said, he said, really, did it smell very bad? So he used to tease the Western monks much worse than that as well. So many, many monks who would be like that. Ajahn Bunjong is another famous example. He's a very lovely, good-humoured monk who runs one of the best reputations for meditation in all the Ajahn Chah disciples. And he was always, he's a great impersonator. And every evening at the evening drinks time, he'll just be impersonating all these different kind of characters, all the local people in the village or whoever they are, or different monks and things like that. And then the monks will be just rolling around in stitches. And then he goes back to his kuti and does very deep meditation. And so on and so forth for many different people. Ajahn Lumpur Jan is another great example. They have a very earthy sense of humour. So even though there is a sense, yes, there is a sense where there's a propriety and a dignity and so on around the robe and a sense of proper occasion and so on, but there's also a sense of the appropriateness of being relaxed about that and not taking it too seriously. And I think this is where a lot of the problems within the Sangha comes is from taking the externals too seriously, not taking the internals seriously enough. So I think one of the cr- crucial things, really, 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 really important things for all of us as monastics is to, how do we find that yathāsakaṁ paṭibhānaṁ? How do we find that according to one's own inspiration? What is it that inspires you? You know, Joseph Campbell used to say, follow your bliss, which is, you know, it's the same kind of thing. I mean, of course, it's not just follow any old bliss, it has to be the right kind of bliss. But even the right kind of bliss, there's many ways of doing it. And we saw in that Mahāgosīṅga Sutta that many monks have different things that they're interested in and different things that they emphasize. And it's not a kind of list of one of these is better than the other. Each one is beautiful from its own perspective. But it's mainly beautiful because of the sense that it's right for that person, not because it's been imposed on that person. So this is really, really important to do that. That you all have to figure this out for yourself. What is your own inspiration? What is the thing that's actually going to keep you alive? What is the thing that's going to feed your heart? You know? Is it going to be, you know, just meditating in seclusion and not ever speaking to anybody? Is it going to be working in the community? Is it going to be serving by doing teachings or helping with the physical things in the monastery or doing text research or what is it? What's your thing? It doesn't just have to be one thing, but you need to find something which is got that sense of inspiration for you. And I always remember that when I first because I know this for myself, because I felt and still do feel from coming from the forest tradition a sense of kind of almost inadequacy or wrongness in the fact that I was interested in textual studies. It was something I was never supported or encouraged to do, and so I felt a bit apologetic about it, a bit embarrassed about the fact that I actually read books and thought that some of the things I learnt in those books were interesting and important, and that I couldn't go along with the more hardcore forest teachings, which you just say throw away all the books and never read any. And I never could make myself believe that. And when I went to see one rains retreat, my third rains retreat, I had done my knee in and I couldn't walk very much. And so one of the results of that was that I spent some more time, because I couldn't do walking meditation except on crutches, so that wasn't very conducive. So I spent some more time doing reading and study. And when I went to see my teacher, Ajahn Mahachachai, and he said, oh, how's your meditation going? I said, oh, well, it hasn't been so good this range because I've been doing some more study and reading the suttas. And he immediately picked that up, you know, and really spoke directly to that, much faster than anybody else I've ever been with, and just said, you know, you should never... He really noticed that I had that sense of inadequacy about that. And he really spoke directly to that and said, you know, never feel that there's something wrong or inappropriate or inadequate about the fact that you're studying the Buddha's words. You should always rejoice in that and think what a wonderful, amazing, marvelous thing it is that you have the chance to be able to study the Buddha's teachings. Never think that there's anything wrong or limited or inadequate about that. And so that was very... very powerful words for me, very inspiring. And so this is something always to bear in mind, that we have to think about. Actually, everything we're doing is really wonderful. So please don't go around thinking, oh, this is better than that, or I need to be doing this, or I need to be doing that, or whatever. Everything is really wonderful. It's really amazing that we have the chance to be here. It's really amazing that we have the chance to be here with this group of people. So amazing that we have this wonderful place, this clean air, this beautiful bushland. It's so amazing that we have all these books and Dhamma books. We can learn. we can improve ourselves. We can study the teachings. We can have those actual teachings that have been passed down to us at such a tremendous cost of human endeavor over thousands of years. And we actually have those. All we have to do is pick it up and read it. It's an amazing thing. And we have so many resources and so much support for our practice here. We should never think that there's anything that's wrong. Everything is beautiful that we do here. Being able to have the chance to sweep up means we're sweeping, we're cleaning the ground so that the monks and nuns, laymen, laywomen who are living here, the people who are coming to support us, they get the chance to use that swept and cleaned area. Whenever I arrive to the monastery, to the main house, and I come and I see that the front porch area has been swept and is nice and clean and tidy, it always makes me feel really good. Because I think of all the work and effort that we've put into making that a nice space and to keep it nice and clean and maintained, it makes me feel really lovely. So everything is really beautiful. And never go around complaining and whinging about anything. What have we got to complain about? What have we got to complain about? Nothing. Everything is really beautiful. And so we just rejoice in the chance to do even just a little bit. You know, even those small things that we can do in terms of helping each other or doing that little bit of extra work to help around the place. I've said this before in a talk sometime, that when I was a young monk, and one time I was, I think I was still a novice. I think I was the youngest novice in the monastery, and Ajahn Pasano asked for somebody to volunteer to do a particular job, just a simple job that needed like half an hour's work after the meal. And Ajahn Pasano asked for volunteers, and none of the monks put their hands up. I was so embarrassed. I was really ashamed that nobody in the Sangha was willing to give up half an hour of their time to help do some work for the monastery. And so, of course, I put my hand up and I made this determination that I would always volunteer whenever anybody asked for work. And so every monastery I've stayed in, I've kept that. Every time that somebody's asked me to do work, or asked generally for work to be done, I've always volunteered every time, until several times the abbots have said, you know, Sijato, put your hand down, it's time for somebody else to do the work. You're already doing this and that and the other and the other. And I've never regretted it. Not once have I ever regretted doing all those things, and not once have I ever felt that because of that there was any limitation or holding back in my Dhamma practice. Absolutely not. You know, I've seen, you know, you can see and you know from talking to people what's holding people back is that sense of self that says, I don't want to. I actually don't want to go and do that extra bit, do that thing to help. And this is what's the holding people back in practice. And when I look at people over many years of watching people I've ordained with, the young monks and so on, over the years of practice, and then I see people who have those kinds of attitudes, they don't flourish, they don't grow in the Dhamma. They just keep on being cynical and negative, and it just stays, it's not healthy. I don't know, Ajahn Brahma always said the same thing, and he was a similar kind of character, and he would always end up doing things because he's very competent at them. And he said, yeah, but he would always have much better meditation than those monks who were, you know, wouldn't do things, who were complaining about them and trying to get out of doing work. So this is not something small or something trivial. It's something that's actually very, very, really goes to the heart of what it means to be Sangha together. what kind of relationship or connection do we have? You know, the Metta Sutta says, well, just like a mother would give her life for her only child. And we read earlier in the week about the Chula Gosenga Wood Sutta and about the monks sort of just doing whatever they can, and they think, why don't I set aside my own, what's in my own mind, and do what's in the mind of these other venerables? And then I do in fact put aside what's in my own mind and do what's in the mind of those other venerables. And so we are different in body, but we are one in mind. That's very beautiful, isn't it? Very beautiful ideal. And you know, you think about it, if we're capable of doing that, if we really think like that, if we really want to say, you know, whatever I want to, what is it is I want to do, I just give it up. And we do that all the time. Wouldn't that be a wonderful place to be living in? Wouldn't that be a wonderful community? And wouldn't that community be a community of people who are so empty of themselves, empty of their own agendas, their own issues? Isn't that amazing, to be able to give yourself to what others want or what others expect or think? There's a very, very lovely sense of emptiness in that. But that has to be coming from your own inspiration again. It has to be coming from a place of saying, this is what I see, this is what I understand to be the right thing. It can't be coming from a place of being forced to do it. If you're being forced to do it, then it's not going to work. But you have to actually feel it from in yourself, how that is. And so the feeling from yourself means practicing with compassion, with empathy for others, putting yourself in those shoes, asking, how do they feel about this? If I speak in this way or do this or whatever, how do they feel? What kind of effect does it have? So to be constantly reflecting on that, what effect is my speech having on others? And so we learn to be true to ourselves. But be true to yourself in a deep way, not in a trivial way. Normally, we try to be true to ourselves. We do that by the kind of hat we wear or the kind of clothes we wear, all these kind of trivial things. And this is where the conflicts come in, because people have the differences. But the real being true to ourselves is coming from our own sense of humanity. The real being true to ourselves, really who we are at bottom, is being a conscious, sentient being. Speaking from that place of knowing suffering, and of speaking from that heart which understands what is suffering and what is happiness. And when we're speaking from that, then that is true to ourselves, and then that will never be anything which will be a cause of conflict or difficulty with others. This is what we need to get to. So if we're able to operate from that place, to speak from that place, to act from that place, to think from that place of knowing what is the Four Noble Truths, then we're able to be totally ourselves, totally peculiar, totally eccentric. So you can wear, you know, sunglasses and smoke pipes and all of the other eccentricities that some monks have. Doesn't matter. But you'll be speaking from that sense which is totally peculiar to yourself and totally universal as well, and totally part of what everybody, where everybody else is at. This is where it becomes very beautiful. So this is my little talk for you this evening. I offer this for your inspiration. And if anyone has any comments or questions. Personal boundaries. What do you mean by personal boundaries? Yeah, of course. I mean, you have to be, have to have common sense about things as well. So a lot of these things are very normal. You know, so in a sense, these things like Dhamma isn't something which supersedes normality, but it's something which allows you to be normal more comfortably. Because you're just happy with it. So sometimes it's a good thing to ignore those things and just say, well, I'm really exhausted and blah, 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 and just ignore it and do it anyway. Other times then you just sort of say, oh, listen, I'm sorry, I'm really tired. And you can't do it. But it certainly doesn't hurt to, it depends on different people have different characters. Sometimes, I think for most of us it doesn't hurt to do, you know, a lot of things that we don't necessarily want to do. And I certainly find myself in many situations where I'm being asked to do things that I just don't really want to do at all. And sometimes I resist it and try not to, and manage to succeed occasionally. And but equally many times you just do it anyway, and sometimes of course they're the best ones when you realize that the reason that you were thinking why you couldn't do it actually is just because of your own fears or whatever. But also, you know, when that's coming from a sense of self, like if you're just trying to do it because you're trying to be, as they used to say I remember Sudarsana used to say, Mr. Bhikkhu. So you're trying to be Mr. Bhikkhu. I don't know what you do for the bhikkhunis, have a different one, but they probably have different kinds of defilements, I guess, but the bhikkhus, it's almost like you've got the kind of the Mr. Bhikkhu award for the year. And so you've got to sort of try to be Mr. Bhikkhu and do all the right things. And so if you're trying to be Mr. Bhikkhu and then you sort of pushing to do those things out of a sense of self, then that's being inauthentic to yourself. Because it's coming from a sense of inadequacy. And so you're trying to project a kind of a hyper self. I don't know what the nuns have instead of trying to be Mr. Bhikkhu. Is there any equivalent?
Nani nun. I call it nunny behaviour.
Nunny behaviour?
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean?
Sort of really meek and humble and supercilious and...
Isn't that how it's supposed to be? There's nanny behaviour as opposed to monkey behaviour, I suppose.
Monks don't seem to suffer from it as much as
men. I think that's also important, like you said before, that there is space for the person who needs to just go into their kuti or into their caravan and cry for 2 days.
Oh yeah, for sure. It should be a special job for that in the monastery. You know, like someone who does the sweeping and someone who cleans the dhanasala and someone who goes and cries in their kuti for 2 days. That should be a special role. Should be a special sangha officer who's appointed to do that. That'd be good, actually. Then they can do it for everyone else. They can be like the scapegoat. They can go and cry, do everybody's crying for them. You know, you take turns. It takes a certain courage.